Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. I'm Kimberly St. Julian Varnin, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Claudia Sadowski-Smith, Associate Professor of English at Arizona State University. We're going to be discussing her new book, The New Immigrant Whiteness: Race, Neoliberalism, and Post-Soviet Migration to the United States. Claudia, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Claudia, can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. So I have a PhD in English and with a focus on multi-ethnic contemporary US literature. And in my earlier work, especially my first book, Border Fictions, which came out in 2008, I studied literary and cultural representations of immigration and US land borders with Mexico and Canada. And so I've specifically focused on Asian and Latin American migration across those boundaries and fiction by Mexican and Canadian authors about those geographies as they have been transfigured by states and international forces. And I was looking at the 20th century, turn of the 20th and 21st centuries. And then the book took me to more comprehensive research on the historical and contemporary migration across US borders. And I realized that Europeans had also crossed those borders and been involved in movement across the borders that had not actually been studied systematically, especially when it comes to the contemporary moment. And I realized, you know, as I was doing this research, and actually it resulted in an article in American Quarterly, which is one of the leading journals in my field in American studies, I realized that there was the absence of any kind of inquiry into the more contemporary movement from specifically what used to be the former Eastern Bloc, comprised of the former Yugoslavia, Romania, Bulgaria, and of course the USSR. So that's how I got into the subject of my second book that you just mentioned.
And so coming into the book, and can you tell us about what are you looking at? And it seems like your take on this post-Soviet diaspora migration is different from pretty much most of the work that's been done in the study of migrants and immigration in the United States.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I'm not an actual expert in Russian and Eastern European studies. I wasn't trained in the field. I was trained in American studies. And I'm coming at this migration from the point of view of how immigration to the United States has been studied, both within specifically in immigration studies, U.S.-based immigration studies, and also within American studies, U.S. American studies itself. And as you know, and I think it's pretty obvious, the focus has been on the largest immigrant groups who have come to the United States since 1965, specifically, and the passage of the Immigration Nationality Act then. And those were groups from Latin America and Asia. And I'm using Latin America as a shorthand term to refer to the largest groups that come from Mexico and now Central America as well. So there really hasn't been a lot of attention to other groups, especially groups that would be considered numerically smaller that have come to the United States. And being myself, having grown up in East Germany and coming to the United States in 1992, right after the dissolution of the former Eastern Bloc, I was very interested. I've always been paying attention to the growth of this particular population. And as I said, people coming from various different countries of the former Eastern Bloc. And initially, I wanted to write a book that would look at all these different groups. And I realized that was just too aspirational. And as I was looking at some census numbers and realized that about 2 million immigrants would have identify themselves as having come from the former Eastern Bloc. But out of that number, the largest group, about 1 million, are from the former USSR. So I realized I wanted to do a more realistic project, although it turned out to be a very long project anyway, but and focus on one of those groups. And so I looked at people having come from the former USSR, primarily since the late 1980s. And I wanted to see how that group has been received and represented in U.S. discourses, specifically cultural discourses that would have been influential on politics as well, and also what some alternative representations would have been. So my focus is really on representations of this group in the United States and not so much outside of the United States. So that's probably how my work is different from that of other Russianists and Eastern Europeanists. And it's more in line with what American studies folks would be doing.
So in your book, and it was actually kind of surprising, I didn't know this. So that post-Soviet migrants represent a large number of migrants coming to the United States, particularly in the 90s, but also they represent a large number of migrants who are also undocumented in some cases.
Right. So the focus of my book, what I'm trying to do is as I was saying, I was trying to see how has this group been received and represented, if at all. So there is as I said earlier, there is really a lack of any kind of systemic study of this group. If at all, there's work in specifically Jewish studies, it focuses on, and also by some Jewish assistance organizations, and it focuses on those who came as Jewish refugees in the early part of the diaspora, mainly the late 1980s, the early 90s. But of course, people smaller groups arrived since the late 1970s when the Soviet Union actually allowed people to leave, specifically dissidents and those who were able to come as Jewish refugees. And as your listeners know, and as you know, because of the high intermarriage in the USSR, not all of those coming as families, as Jewish refugees, were themselves Jewish, right? So there are numbers that show that about half of those were family members that were not actually Jewish. But the focus has been on this particular group and not on the larger diaspora, which has actually changed throughout the 1990s, where in the early 1990s, about 90% of people coming from the USSR would have come under these refugees, religious refugee categories. But by the late 1990s, that number had dropped to about 40%. So I was interested in studying the larger diaspora and in really studying its ethnic diversity or national diversity and also its legal diversity. That's what I focus on in the book, and especially the latter part. The book is structured in such a way that every chapter looks at one different form of legal migration or arrival to the United States. So the argument I'm making is that maybe more than other immigrant groups, the post-Soviet migrants actually participate in every available form of migration to the United States. So they come as highly skilled as refugees, or they have come as refugees, initially political refugees, but also religious refugees, and not just Jewish refugees, but also as Catholic Ukrainians came and evangelical Christians. And then as highly, and this is what I look at in my first chapter, as highly skilled in marriage migrants. I look at that in my second chapter as adoptive migrants. I look at that in my third chapter. And as you mentioned, they would come on so-called non-immigrant visas, usually visitor visas or sometimes student or work visas, and then overstay them. And so I also focus on that particular movement in chapter four. And I try to I'm trying to figure out in the book how arrival on these different legal categories then shapes the ways in which these migrants get to access U.S. citizenship rights in different ways, and how it helps them or makes it more difficult to them to assimilate, and I'm using that word in quotation marks, and to create collective and new collective migrant identities. And as you, in your question, you asked me about the number of or statistics on post-Soviet immigrants who came or who overstayed their visas. We generally know in immigration studies that about 40% of the unauthorized population in the United States are so-called visa overstayers. And we know that the majorities come from Europe and Canada, but there really aren't numbers exactly on how many people come from various different European countries. They are kind of grouped together. The numbers that we have, which basically come from the Border Patrol and talk about apprehensions or also people who are not admitted to the United States. So it's difficult to know what the number is, generally speaking. But I mean, it is significant. And I do talk about how in my interviews with post-Soviet immigrants, several of them mentioned having personally known or having knowledge of people who were visa overstayers from the former Soviet Union. So what I look at in this book is I examine reality TV shows, memoirs by parents of adoption, and then also fiction by post-Soviet immigrant authors who came to the United States mainly as children or adolescents about migration from the former Soviet Union and successor states, and specifically the 1980s. And then I also look at the result of interviews that I conducted with migrants from the former Soviet Union in Arizona between 2010 and 2011. And I can talk more about that, but specifically I was interested in their attitudes toward other immigrants, specifically immigrants from Mexico that dominate in Arizona. And at the time, toward discourses about Arizona's Senate Bill 1070, which at the time was the most severe, would impose the most severe limitations on immigrants that were deemed to be undocumented in this country.
There's so many layers to your work. And your first chapter looks at the post-Soviet diaspora and television, and you choose Russian Dolls and Dancing with the Stars as some of your prime examples. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah. So in the first, what I was trying to do is to see, since the diaspora has, or this migration has been mentioned so rarely or is mentioned so rarely, where actually does it get represented? And so I was looking at, because I had realized, you know, having lived in this country since the 90s, that there were some representations of Russians, but not necessarily, or, you know, people from the former Soviet Union, but not necessarily immigrants. They just popped up in shows such as NYPD Blue, you know, The Sopranos, and 24, which 24 is in some shape and form still sort of on TV. They would always pop up as like these people that were sort of in the United States, and they were villains, and they were also associated with terrorists and Middle Eastern, you know, quote unquote terrorists as well. And so then when I thought about these two shows, Dancing with the Stars, which is and Russian Dolls, that are both reality TV shows, I realized what was happening was that these two shows were representing immigrants, usually usually 1.5, so younger immigrants that had come as children or adolescents to this country with their family, probably of Jewish background. Sometimes that wasn't specified, but there were these little clues in both of these shows. So that they were presenting these immigrants, their cast members, in very different ways, no longer as villains and terrorists or even in stereotypical forms as mail order brides, but they were associating them with they were showing them as so to speak predecessors of earlier European immigrants that had come to this country at the turn of the 20th century and had been associated with these mythologized, idealized ideas of upward mobility and assimilation. And so the idea that was presented that these cast members were associated with was that they would be expected to follow the same trajectory. And not only were they associated with these ideas of what emerged in the United States, is this notion of a pan-European whiteness, which emerged after World War II, and which basically means that, or is supposed to indicate that everyone of European background is just considered to be white. But more specifically, they were associated with this emerging collective Russian, quote unquote, identity, which was equated to this ethnicized idea of whiteness, version of whiteness that was supposed to be very similar, at least in the case of Russian dolls, to an Italian American version of whiteness. So Russian dolls, which was actually scripted and written by two post-Soviet immigrants, was explicitly modeled after Jersey Shore, and very similar notions of white immigrant, ethnic immigrant identity were associated with these cast members. So I thought those were really interesting ideas. And one other thing that came up in both of the shows that I also thought very noteworthy was that these immigrant casts were in different ways, either explicitly or not so explicitly, also set apart from the majority of other contemporary non-white immigrants, particularly Mexican immigrants or Latinos, Latinas and Latins more generally, and sometimes even portrayed as being hostile toward these groups. So the idea that was represented in these two shows was that the post-Soviet immigrants are very different than other contemporary U.S. immigrants, and that they're following different trajectories that might not be available to other immigrants.
So you have some really good examples of this in your discussion of Dancing with the Stars. And one of the particular, I guess, starring dancers of the show, Maxim Chermikovsky, yeah. and how they portray him and his brother and other, post-Soviet migrants and their stories, and how their migration stories change depending on the market the show is being shown in. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. It's been difficult to find. So number one, these shows do not ever focus on migration stories. They just focus on the end result, which is, okay, these folks are here now. They've had to overcome some adversity, but clearly by being on the show itself, which is one of the ideas of reality TV, is that if you're a cast member, that might put you on a path toward upward mobility just by participating in a reality TV show. So, and of course, in the case of these particular Chermikovsky brothers, for example, that is pretty much true because they've been on the show for a long time. They get paid to be on the show. So they're portrayed as successful and upwardly mobile on the show, and as having made it, as having achieved this American immigrant dream of immigrant success. So the actual difficulties that the brothers went through after they arrived in the United States are actually downplayed and never mentioned, as is their Jewish ethnicity. Their father is Jewish, and that doesn't really get mentioned on the show at all. Most of the information that I was able to gather about the brothers, and specifically about Maxim, was because he also participated in a Ukrainian reality TV show, the Ukrainian version of The Bachelor, which apparently was widely watched in Ukraine. And on that show, his migration experience was portrayed very differently. So we did find out he was able to talk about all these difficulties that his family underwent. The fact that his father, who'd been well trained in the Soviet Union, which is one of the the typical characteristics of this diaspora, that both women and men who come from the former Soviet who have come from the former Soviet Union are highly trained and well educated, especially compared to the other contemporary U.S. immigrants. So, but upon arrival in the United States, several of them, or a majority of them, have problems working in those professions, and they end up moving downward economically. And that's exactly what happened to Chermikovsky's father as well. He worked as a dishwasher, and the family was poor. And so Maxim talks about how he was, when he was 14, he opened his own dance studio. that dancing was one of the things that that he, just as many other cast members on the show from the former USSR, had been engaged in his case in what became in Ukraine, and that it was one of the skills that he realized he had that he could really use in the United States to make a living and help his parents and his family to make a living. And that's really how his love of dance developed, and he made it into a profession. He still talks about this in interviews today, that it was just one of the skills that he had and that he felt like he needed to develop in the United States. One of the points I make in this chapter is that because of the influx of post-Soviet immigrants in the United States since specifically the late 1980s, we have had this explosion in international ballroom dancing, which is a European form of ballroom dancing rather than a U.S. form in the United States. We've had these shows, Dancing with the Stars being one of them, on TV, and also a growth in ballroom studios. So that's one measurable impact that this migration has had on the culture, on actually reconfiguring the culture in the United States.
Interesting. And so you touch on this in your answer about the question about Maxim, how his father had this highly skilled background when he was in the Soviet Union and he came over, and how that kind of changed once he was in the United States. And in your second chapter, you have this interesting look at highly skilled migrants to America. And then you also look at the women who receive marriage visas. And so can you talk about those two groups and their differences and their experiences once they get to the United States?
Right. And so this goes back to this one of these main arguments I'm trying to make in this book, which is the assumption in immigration studies is that the ways that shared collective characteristics of an immigrant group understood to be a group that comes from a specific area of other, you know, of the world, and therefore is nationally or ethnically formed. That's how that group coheres. So the idea is that these shared collective features, such as, you know, education and skill sets, but also the ways in which they're racialized in the United States based upon their national origin or ethnic origin, that those characteristics are important for or shape the ways in which this group assimilates to the United States or develops identities, collective cultural identities that sometimes take on transnational forms. So because this particular diaspora has been understood, as I was trying to explain earlier, to be collectively white, associated with notions of whiteness that even downplay Jewish components, even though, of course, if one thinks geographically speaking, most of the earlier immigrants that came to the United States from what then became the Soviet Union and was then the Russian Empire, or more specifically the Pale of Settlement within the Russian Empire, were Jewish, were speaking Yiddish, and assimilated to a Jewish American identity that had already been formed by Central America, those coming from Central Europe, specifically Germans. And to actually think about these more contemporary immigrants as following in the footsteps of those immigrants would actually make more sense. But that's not what these representations are doing. They're thinking of them as being more alike, akin to Italian Americans, right? So these two features, thinking about immigration studies, these two features would set this particular diaspora very much apart from other contemporary U.S. immigrants who are racialized as non-white mainly, and who don't necessarily have the same highly educated backgrounds. But what I'm trying to do is, in this book, is I'm trying to see how are these collective features complicated by the ways in which particular segments of the diaspora arrive on different legal status. How does that actually impact how they assimilate and create cultural identities? And so my second chapter that you're asking me about is one that came out of these interviews I conducted with over 30 immigrants in Arizona. And what I didn't realize until I conducted the interviews is that the majority of people that I was talking to fell into two different groups. And those were those who came as highly skilled immigrants I didn't get to talk with anyone who arrived on an H-1B visa and would be working in private business, but I talked to people who came on one student visa, a J-1, and were working in my institution, we're working in an institution of higher education, but had come on J-1s previously, entered the United States on J-1s. And then the second group I talked to were the marriage migrants, so women who had arrived on what's called a fiancé visa, a K-1 visa. And what I realized is that these two groups had very different trajectories in the ways in which they then, settled in the United States, assimilated here, and were able to or not able to also create new cultural identities. So marriage migrants had way more restricted access to economic forms of citizenship, even though they were, the ones I talked to all had university degrees and work experience in the former Soviet Union or in successor states. And they were marrying men in the United States that were middle class or upper class, of middle or upper class background. They were able to immediately work in the United States because they were they received green cards, temporary green cards, and then eventually green cards or citizenship. But they still had a very difficult time finding jobs that were suitable to that background. They never actually did. They worked in unskilled service occupations, or they were creating their own businesses. And they were very much interested in creating a sort of at least a Ukrainian or Russian-speaking environment for their children, and faced greater difficulties connecting to other post-Soviet immigrants who had arrived on other legal categories. And they were much more often considered returning home because they were unhappy, much more unhappy in the United States than those who had come on highly skilled visas. Specifically, because they had married men who did not speak Russian or Ukrainian, that the majority of women I talked to had come from Russia or Ukraine, they were not able to pass on the language and sometimes the culture to their children. And they also just didn't feel like they fit in as well. Whereas, and they were also subjected to these very high expectations of complete assimilation to middle-class whiteness. And that often occurred at the cost of their own and also their children's bicultural identities. Whereas the highly skilled migrants that came and that I talked to, they immediately, even though they came on, rather precarious positions that were very often limited to a particular time period, the J-1 visa is only limited to 5 years, I believe. And they were, they were, as many other contingent faculty in and the universities, they were underpaid, but yet they were immediately, because these positions were putting them on a path to middle-class existence, they were immediately racialized as white. They weren't really as interested in creating an ethnic community, and they also didn't necessarily maintain the same transnational connections that the marriage migrants had, and they weren't as interested in returning. So I thought those were interesting findings.
There really are. It was really interesting. You talk about how some of the women who receive these marriage visas, how they're kind of ostracized even by the highly skilled women who are coming on these visas, that there's some tension there between those two groups of women.
Exactly. Or even other women that had come. I talked to somebody who had come on a student visa in order to get, this was an F1 in her case, but to conduct graduate studies in the United States. And she said that she was basically purposefully staying away from women who had come as marriage migrants. There was this idea that they did not come in quote unquote the right way. And they only chose to get married in order to enter the United States. So yeah, and the women themselves that I talked to, the marriage migrants, would say that it was much more difficult to them to make connections to these couples that had come together, where often the men had come on highly skilled visas and they had brought their wives, or where they were saying they still have a community that seems as though it is very much, you know, still a Russian or Ukrainian speaking community. And they themselves were just not able to create those kinds of communities themselves because they had men, they had husbands who not only did not speak any of these languages, but also were not interested in speaking them. And sometimes actually opposed their wives speaking those, speaking either Russian or Ukrainian to their children.
And yeah, that was one of the sadder aspects of that chapter when you talk about these women and they're wanting to go home because they can't even share that culture with their children because of the situation with their husbands. So it kind of segues into your third chapter, which honestly was one of the hardest chapters to read when you're discussing adoption and the transnational adoption of children from the post-Soviet space. Can you give us some examples and talk about your argument in that chapter, but also the experiences of these children?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because that was also my experience writing this chapter. In fact, this was the first piece I wrote for the book. I mean, and it appeared in slightly different form as an article. And I remember not being able to sleep for several nights after when I was doing this research because I really honestly didn't know. I didn't have a sense of the depth of some of these issues that adoption has brought with it. So generally speaking, the adoption scholarship in this country has looked mainly at the two largest groups of adoptees that came from China. And China is still the leading country of adoption to this day. And from South Korea. South Korea is the country from which the United States has adopted for the longest. And the adoption scholarship has really focused on issues of race and the racialization of these adoptees in the United States. One of the main foci of the scholarship has been to try and tell parents, adoptive parents, who are mostly, the U.S. adoptive parents are mostly white or consider themselves white and middle class or upper middle class, to realize that their children would be racialized not as white, but, you know, most likely as Asian in this country, and to help them prepare for that by exposing them to what is very often called in a scholarship, quote unquote, birth culture. So this culture would be, so basically parents would be expected, and adoption agencies tell parents to do this as well, to expose their adopted children to, let's say, Chinese dance and Chinese language and other forms of Chinese culture. In the case of adoptees from Russia and Ukraine, those two countries opened themselves up for a transnational adoption in 1991, and they were the largest sending countries for adoption sending countries throughout the 1990s, and then even in the contemporary period, I just looked up the most recent numbers. And Ukraine is still one of the leading 10 countries, origin countries, for adoption, whereas, of course, Russia closed the door to adoption in 2013 in the Magnitsky Act. And yet that's something that's come up recently as well, of course, with the invocation of our current administration in Russia. But anyway, so what happened with the immigration of those children is, and that I could really trace in these three memoirs of adoption that I selected to discuss. There are many, many more. There's been a search in these memories and in these memoirs in the 1990s, and I read many of them, but I narrowed it down to these three. What I could see in there is that because these adoptive parents were selecting children because parents get to choose where they want it, more or less, where they want to adopt from. And these parents were choosing Russia or Ukraine specifically because they felt that the children there were white, and so white like them, and so that if they adopted those kinds of children into their families, they would create families whose members would look as though they would be biologically related. And so therefore, the idea for many of these parents is that it would be easier for them to make these children part of their families, to not have to deal with intrusive questions from the outside, and to create more successful adoptions. To the extent that in these three memoirs, the authors would move from a position where it was very important for them to select healthy children, of course, and that would be one of the priorities, and that they would even reject referrals for children where there were questions about the health status or there wasn't enough information supplied, which is also very, very typical for the adoption process. They went from that position to a position throughout this various periods of several years where they would actually choose children. They would privilege children for their whiteness over their health status. And they would actually, one of the authors actually rejected a referral in a hospital in Russia for a child that did not look quote unquote white enough. And the author specifically states this. And that was very shocking to me that a white outward appearance that could be racialized in that way would be so important for these parents that they would be writing about this adoption process as one in which they were customers who would have the right to select these healthy or, more importantly, sometimes white children in order to forge these kinds of families. And I traced in the chapter how these narratives are really moved away from the more traditional narrative of adoption that U.S. parents have used in other memoirs, or that's been used generally speaking in this country to think about transnational adoption, where it is really supposedly a humanitarian act. It's about saving the children, right? Saving, in quotation mark, the children from their fates and from poverty or from war or from famine or abuse. Here in these memoirs, it is really about the parents. It's about the parents who have the right to make these kinds of choices and who also have the right to reject referrals. They have the right to actually end, terminate adoptions and so on and so forth, solely based on the question of what they perceive as a racialized, the race of their children. And so what I speculate in the chapter is that maybe this attitude then might explain why we have seen such a relatively high number of abuse cases and specifically death of adoptees from Russia, specifically at the hands of their U.S. adoptive parents, which of course was also one of the factors that led to the passage, at least officially to the passage, to the termination of adoptions from Russia.
It's a really interesting chapter, and it really pulls on your heartstrings when you see these adoptive parents kind of talking about, I guess, this marketplace for children. And you it really touches upon your argument about the impact of neoliberalism and how you see it in the way adoptions have changed during that time. So right. Looking at...
And also the way in which, I guess one more point to make about that I haven't been able to make yet, is also the ways in which the notions of whiteness in the United States as, encompassing everyone who's here and has European background, that this particular notion now has been globalized to such an extent that people outside of the United States who are residents of, European countries or countries that are thought to be strictly European, which they're not, right? Like Russia really isn't, but that these residents are already racialized as white even before they come to this country. That's a big change too in the ways in which race and immigration have interacted in the U.S. context. So we now have this idea that residents of the former USSR or of many parts of the former USSR are already white, and therefore they become these privileged objects of migration. They are desirable objects for migration, and they get to migrate within what are rather privileged categories, specifically as adoptees. That's a very privileged category of immigration, where adoptive children since the early 2000s are become citizens once the adoption in the United States is completed. So there is this real shift in the notion of what whiteness means as well. And it works as a privilege for marriage and adoptive migrants, but it also works, and this is, I think, what I've been trying to say, the flip side of that is that there's this heightened expectation on marriage migrants and an adoptive migrants to totally assimilate immediately, or not think about or take into consideration their cultural, national, ethnic differences and their linguistic differences, and that then impedes in the case of marriage migrants the development of bicultural identities and transnational identities. And in the case of adoptees, they're not even given the option that is given to other adoptees of like exposure to anything resembling their birth culture at all, right? So they don't, in the case of Artyom Savelyev, with whom I start the chapter, and of course, it became a very prominent case in 2011, where his mother had adopted him in the United States and then just sent him back, quotation marks, to Russia. He had been adopted, he was 7 years old, into the United States. And after 6 months, when she sent him back, he couldn't even speak Russian anymore, right? So that there is this complete disregard for the difference of these children when they come to the United States because of this strange association with whiteness.
And so looking at your fifth chapter, when you're looking at the diaspora in a comparative perspective, do these post-Soviet migrants, or do they understand that they have that layer of whiteness that like Latino and Central American immigrants don't necessarily have? Are they aware of that? And does that shape how they think of themselves versus the dark-skinned POC migrants?
Yeah, so that's really what I wanted to get at in this chapter too, that specific question, because as I was saying earlier, the discourses that are available are just assume, you know, that because they're white, that these immigrants are completely different from other contemporary immigrants, and that they might even be hostile to them, because I didn't get to talk about this yet, but whiteness historians who have traced the development and evolution of whiteness in this country for immigrants from Europe, that's one of the main assertions that they have made, that they were folks from Ireland, Italy, Southern Europe and Eastern Europe were able to completely and fully enter into whiteness by World War II because they were always having to set themselves in opposition to, at the time, African Americans mainly, and this much smaller number of Chinese immigrants as well. And they having and some of this opposition also would then manifest itself in outright hostility and participation in anti-immigrant. For example, support of anti-immigrant legislation such as the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act by Irish laborers and specifically the unions, so that they could only achieve whiteness through opposition to folks considered non-white. So that's what I wanted to get at in these interviews. Is this really? Can we really think about immigrants from the former Soviet Union in the same way? And what I found, so I asked these immigrants specifically about their attitudes toward SB 1070, which was at the time being passed in Arizona and was making undocumented residents or in the country a state crime. And so it would allow state authorities to detain or arrest immigrants on the suspicion of them being undocumented in the country. And what I found is that the vast majority of my interviewees, and I interviewed around 30 participants, were not supportive of the passage of this legislation. They felt ambivalent about it, and that's mainly because, yes, they did feel that they would be exempted from this legislation. They did understand that the legislation was targeting and profiling Latino and Latina and Latinx in this country, and specifically Mexican immigrants. They did understand that. But they also, and they did understand to a certain extent, I mean, some folks said things like, you know, I'm white, so I wouldn't be stopped. They did understand that they have this privilege of whiteness, but they also did bring up that they wouldn't be affected by this law because they had entered under different legal conditions, mainly as documented immigrants. That was very important for those who had come on K2 fiancé visas, and they would very much make that argument about, well, we had to go through all these problems and we were documented. But they still felt empathetic and sympathetic toward Mexican migrants who would be targeted. primarily because of two reasons. One was because they said, we are immigrants. And one person even said, we're always going to be immigrants, even if we're white. We're still immigrants. They did talk about, sometimes I had to prod them a little bit, but they did talk about incidences of xenophobia against them as well. Not to say that they were not in order to make the point that they were being marginalized in the same way as Mexican immigrants. They realized that that was not the case, but just to say that there was a grounds for empathy because xenophobia in the United States does not stop necessarily at people who are racialized as non-white. But also the second ground for empathy was that they understood from having grown up in the Soviet Union and then some folks talking about present-day Russia, that this kind of intrusion by the state into the lives of everyday people, and specifically those considered different and racialized different, was something that they had experienced in the past, and they just didn't think that should be a feature of a democratic country like the United States. So on those, what I think the conclusion I drew was that because most of these immigrants that I talked to, and I did talk to, by the way, I didn't get to mention this, but I did talk to three immigrants who would not have been, who were not racialized in the United States as white because of the background they had as either Native Aboriginal people in Russia, Jewish, being of Jewish background, and one person being Armenian, and they were talking about how in the United States they were racialized as Asian or Jewish or Middle Eastern, quote unquote. But the majority of the folks I talked to would have been or thought that they were racialized as white, and I think they understood that, but the conclusion I reached, this is not something they said, but that's what I reached from the interviews, is because the majority of people were racialized securely as white, they didn't have to, as turn of the century European immigrants, struggle to be seen as white or integrated into whiteness. So they didn't necessarily have to have the same level of opposition to folks racialized as non-white. And of course, when one looks at the scholarship about turn of the century European immigrations, and I was looking specifically as looking at the work of Eric Goldstein, who looks at immigrants from the Pale of Settlement, one of the, among others, but those who racialized as Jewish Americans in the United States or became Jewish Americans in the United States, there was always this level of resistance to violence against those racialized as non-white, specifically African Americans. And much more of an empathy toward other immigrant groups and the African Americans. So in some ways, that particular scholarship on the emergence of whiteness among European immigrants also overstates its case in some cases. So I was able to see that there were some sort of continuities that were there in the sense that these immigrants felt ambivalent and empathetic. But also a change in the way in which these immigrants were much more securely, the majority of them, securely attached to whiteness.
Do you have any concluding thoughts for our listeners about your book?
So the conclusions that I was trying to reach with this book and why I wrote it to begin with was to show that this group is not actually all that different or uniquely different from other contemporary immigrants. They're dealing with some of the same issues. They're dealing with changes in the way whiteness works. They're dealing with diminished access to benefits that a welfare state and in an economy that worked a lot better when immigrants came at the turn of the 20th century, and that eventually allowed those immigrants and their descendants to, a majority of them, to actually embark on upward mobility, that these contemporary immigrants do not have access to the same kinds of welfare benefits and to the same kinds of economic opportunities, and so they're also dealing with the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment and policy, and so that's what I was trying to show specifically in my last chapter, that I think we need to move beyond seeing these immigrant groups in these stark differences, and to really work toward a more integrative immigration rights movement that could also be open enough and to post-Soviet immigrants or immigrants from Eastern Europe more generally, and that these immigrants themselves would feel that they would be welcome in it and need to work in it as well. Because as we've seen, especially with after our most recent election, the discourses that in the last couple of decades have focused so much, anti-immigrant discourses have focused so much on divisions among documented and undocumented immigrants, targeting undocumented immigrants and making the case that everybody should become an illegal way. Those discourses have been supplanted by very explicit attacks on all forms of migration, including highly skilled migration. And as we see, of course, family migration, family reunification. So in that sense, those coming from the former Soviet Union and other parts of Eastern Europe that make up such a large portion of contemporary migrants, I want them to be seen in such a way that they might be more integrated into our struggle for immigrants' rights in this country. That they themselves see it, but that scholarship also enables that perspective.
Wow, that gives us so much to think about. I mean, in academia, but also outside of the academy. So, well, Claudia, we've taken up a good bit of your time today. So thank you for being on the show.
And before thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Good. And before we go, I have to ask you the famous New Books Network question. What are you working on now?
I'm actually working on a special issue for another American Studies journal called 20th Century Literature, or it's mainly interested in American literature. And what we're trying, we call it literature, a post-socialist literature in the United States. And we're looking at the cultural productions of a variety of immigrant authors from the former Eastern Europe together. So folks from the former Yugoslavia, USSR, Bulgaria and Romania, who have produced mainly fiction, poetry, and also theater in this country, and have achieved acclaim, and also their work's been translated. But this particular work has not been looked at as a cohesive body of work, and that's what we're trying to. Myself and a co-editor, Ioana Luca, who works in Taiwan actually and is Romanian, we're trying to theorize commonalities between these various Eastern European immigrant groups and their cultural productions in this country.
That sounds really interesting. It seems like you're getting more and more into the Russian and Eurasian space.
Yeah, I guess I can't help it.
Well, Claudia, thanks for being on the show today. I think it was a treat for both me and the listeners.
Thank you so much.